program this afternoon here again, further from the Health Services Commission. And Barney and Darren, Barney Spate and Darren Kaufman are here this afternoon. And I don't know whether you want to maybe address some of the issues that were sort of left hanging Monday afternoon. If you would like to, we'd love to have you come. And do you have any clarifying things that you'd like to offer us? You don't?
Well, Madam Chair, I had a couple of questions.
Okay, well, come on up then. While you're thinking about
clarifying, what else you'd like to say?
The primary reason, committee, that I asked them to come back, it seems that when we adjourned on Monday afternoon, that there were still some questions. Actually, Senator Yee, I just found out she's not going to be here. She had two questions. And one of them, however, I didn't really believe were relevant to the Health Services Commission. It really was more a question for the Office of Medical Assistance Program.
The question on copays.
Yes, the copay question was Representative Ross.
Okay. It's my understanding that the governor has proposed a reduction of 10 items off the list for the coming biennium. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Ross, that is correct.
Okay. Would you mind just going over very briefly what those items are and the impact of that, because and not to go into great detail, but we get questions from our constituents about the seriousness of this and whether this is really going to impact quality health services, and I'd just like a real quick review from you on that.
Excuse me, I didn't identify myself for the record. Barney Spate, Administrator of the Office for Oregon Health Plan Policy and Research, and joining me this afternoon is Darren Kaufman, the Director of the Health Services Commission, and to Representative Ross's question regarding what are the line items in a summary fashion included in the 10-line move, I'm going to defer to Darren. Neither one of us are physicians or clinically trained, but Darren's worked with a prioritized list for 10 years or so and understands the coding and nomenclature a lot better than I do.
Madam Chair, Representative Ross, I'll certainly do my best here to put things in layman's terms, since that's what I'm into. Starting with line 574 and working back.
Okay.
Line 574 is titled Venereal Warts Excluding Cervical Condyloma. That's probably, it probably could be a better title to that line. Venereal warts actually appear on three different lines on the prioritized list. Cervical condyloma appears up in the 260 range, and condyloma acuminatum is in the 520 range. Those are the more severe forms of this disease, ones that could be precancerous. These are kind of, if you will, run-of-the-mill warts that grow, and if you were to excise them, cut them off, they would grow back. Treatments aren't extremely effective.
Okay.
And that's why they're down here. Line 573 is dysfunction of nasolacrimal system, which would include like a blockage of the tear duct, something along those lines, causing dry eyes, or you could have excess tearing under this line item as well. Line 572, internal derangement of the knee and ligamentous disruption to the knee, grade 2 and 3. Those are going to be your partial and complete tears of the ligaments within the knee, often as a result of a trauma like a skiing accident, person playing sport to twist the knee in a fashion. They can heal to some degree on their own, and they're usually not a large problem for a person as long as they discontinue those sorts of strenuous types of exercises and whatnot. Line 571 is symptomatic urticaria. That is basically hives. So a rash due to certain external causes.
Poison oak.
What was that again?
Five, symptomatic urticaria, which is line 571.
Is that in fact with an oak?
No, with an oak would be elsewhere, I believe. I'd have to check the exact codes that are included on that line, but I do not believe Poison Oak is in that line, I'm almost certain. This would be like a heat rash, something more along those lines.
Okay.
Line 570, contact dermatitis, atopic dermatitis, another eczema. Really kind of along the same lines as the previous line, symptomatic urticaria. If you ingest the substance and are allergic to it, you're going to have some sort of breakout on your skin. And the mechanism for treating that, obviously, is to understand what caused the reaction and to avoid that. 569, cystic acne, is fairly self-explanatory. It's there are certainly some degrees of acne, and this one is more severe than others. Phimosis, line 568, is a tightening of the foreskin of the penis, and basically if good hygiene is used, then that can be you can avoid infections that may come along with that type of a condition. 567, mechanical urinary obstruction and benign prostatic hyperplasias, the enlargement of the prostate gland in males. Line 566, benign neoplasms of bone and articular cartilage, including osteoid osteomas, benign neoplasm of connective and other soft tissues. Basically growths that are non-malignant in the bone and the connective tissues of the joints. And obviously the treatment there would be to take those out. They might cause discomfort, rubbing of the joints and whatnot. Line 565, sialolithiasis, mucous field disturbance with salivary secretion, other than specified disease of salivary glands, blockage of the salivary glands leading to decreased saliva, dry mouth.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Madam Chair, if the committee or any member of the committee would like more definitive medical with paragraphs developed by somebody with medical expertise, the part-time medical director of the commission would be more than happy to put something together if you'd like more in detail.
I think you wanted less detail.
No.
I'm always hesitant when laymen try to...
Well, and that was the point. I was just trying to get a layman
right.
grasp of what the nature of these things were, because that was my impression, is that they are not terribly serious things, that we were not making a big impact on reducing the medical services that people by eliminating.
There's certainly non-fatal conditions where treatment's going to have some degree of effectiveness, but not as much as others that are placed higher on the list.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome.
That's the only question I have.
Okay.
Senator Schiff, we've been under more general questions in the health plan, but of course you were invited here the other day to talk about death with dignity and so on and its placement. And I just kind of wanted to go over the record with you about what has happened legislatively, where you got your direction from, in the past legislative session. I didn't mention it the other day, but I did recall that there were some bills related to what would happen if the injunction were lifted and stuff. Could you review some of that history for us so I have it straight, and maybe the rest of the committee would like it too?
Certainly, Madam Chair, Senator Shields. There were a number of bills introduced in the 1997 session, some of which Darren and I, my office and the Health Services Commission, was asked to comment on. None of those bills, other than the referral of the statute to the people for a vote, was a number of the past. Some of them did the wide-ranging number of issues, including the issues of both funding and protect conscience protections for providers and things like that. I was asked by written communicator in 1997 by Representative Minnis that if the injunction or physician-assisted suicide became otherwise legal, what did we think that the Health Services Commission would do? And we provided him in writing our best estimate of that if it did become legal, that the Services Commission would take it under advisement and seek to put it on, make a determination of should it be on the list, and then so do so. I can provide copies of that if you or any other member would like. And then, you know, the chronology was the vote and the ultimate determination through the absence of court action that the state statute was at least the law of Oregon. And then direction from the governor's office to the agencies of state government to work on implementing it pursuant to that vote. So that's the chronology as I, in a very summary fashion.
Follow up,
Senator.
If you provide a copy of that letter you're talking about, could you also maybe give us a little synopsis of what some of those other bills were? I mean, we were also focused on the referral debate, that maybe we need to be reminded about what some of those bills were.
I'd be more than happy to
But you said, Mr. Spaces, those bills did not pass?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Well, I would think that if we're in a new session and anybody wanted to address that legislation, that it would have been brought up again since we are in session. So I don't know what maybe Senator Shields, you'd like to have them for your edification, but because it was a previous session, none of them passed, it really isn't relevant to this session. And if we want to have further legislation, that's what we need to do. That's what we're here for.
Madam Chair, I was just trying to establish some legislative history. In fact, some of the bills from the last session are the same as potential bills this session. And I was just trying to get some legislative history so I would know where we've been. Because I'm sure that Barney is much more of an expert on it than I am.
Further questions?
You know what, Madam Chair?
Representative,
I'm still a little bit wondering about the priority list, the lines, and when you get a new, and that was the focus of part of our discussion in the last meeting, and kind of a difficult thing for me to understand, that you take a new thing, not just assisted suicide, but sounds like there may have been other situations to where they have been moved in where there's an already existing prioritized list. Is that what can be done?
Madam Chair, Representative Locum, let me begin to respond to that and then refer to my colleague to my left. The 754 lines?
743.
743 condition treatment pairs.
Mm-hmm.
Each one of those represent a condition, a medical condition that summarizes a number of descriptors of, I will say, similar conditions, but it lumps together, I'm going to use real professional language here,
okay.
It lumps together a number of codes that describe conditions and a number of codes that describe the treatment of those various conditions into a single line. So if you were to look at the way I think of what the Services Commission's task has been, is that there are over 10,000, or there's several thousand descriptors of diseases, and then several tens of thousands of descriptors of treatments for those diseases. And in the prioritization effort, they had to find ways to collapse and put on a given line
similar conditions and similar treatments. And so if you think of a given line that is a summary and a collection of a number of similar treatments and conditions, and a new medical technology comes along that hasn't previously been in the medical armamentarium, then Darren and the commission and its health outcomes will first look to see where in the list of condition treatment payers does that focus in on, and then is that condition or that treatment summarized in the current list, or does it need to be added? Mm-hmm. Similarly, a lot of the work, which are technical changes, are just changes in coding. But in the case of something that's brand new that's come about, that's how I would describe it from my perspective. And is that too much of a disservice of the approach?
Madam Chair, Representative Loken, Representative Throwback at the end of Monday's session had kind of asked a question along those lines, wondering about other new services that might be added during the interim session. And we deal with so many hundreds of thousands of codes that I kind of drew a blank in terms of new services that we've dealt with since the list was first established. And a couple of examples along those lines of new services that have come up kind of during interim periods that we felt that we couldn't really wait until the next biannual review to deal with were laparoscopic surgical procedures that, basically instead of having to do an open procedure for many number of surgeries, removing a spleen or dealing with an ectopic pregnancy, they could do this laparoscopically with a small incision and a scope. And so that was something that came about and was not reflected within the prioritized list at the time, and we added those services. Another example would be stem cell transplantation, where they had previously done a bone marrow transplant, actually physically removed bone marrow, when giving high dose chemotherapy as a treatment for cancers and other situations, and then replenishing a person's bone marrow transplant. With the stem cell transplantation, they could do it drawing peripheral blood cells, and again, you're dealing with something that's less invasive and is still just as effective and often less costly.
A follow-up part of that, that is not adding a line because it hasn't been approved necessarily. It's fitting it into one of these
existing lines.
Codes.
Well, there were in fact new codes that came about once those procedures began use. However, we simply added those new treatment codes to existing line items on a list, finding what conditions you would use that treatment for.
So you went in for the laparoscopic procedure, for instance, on any of the procedures that it could most probably be used for or most efficiently be used on, let's say. Does that answer?
Thank you. I've been wondering, you get something new comes up and then you put it in the middle, how could that be if we're going by this prioritized set of descriptions here or condition pairs?
That's an excellent question, if I may elaborate, Madam Chair, just for a moment. And again, I'm going to get out here on some thin ice, actually, and Darren can save me when I break through. The prioritization of the relative effectiveness of each of the lines, within each of those lines, there are numbers of medical techniques that are encapsulated, if you will, in that line. And there may be, even within the medical community, some debate about one technique that's covered in the line may be more effective or less effective in a given patient situation. The commission has tried to say, when you look at a condition and then you look at it, that an array of treatments that would be summarized under that condition, what is in general, does it save a life? Does it have an effective modality of treatment? And if the answer to that is yes, and they go through their process, it gets prioritized. When the legislature ultimately funds the Oregon Health Plan, and then that prioritized list down to the funding, to that funding line, becomes the benefit package, the health plans that contract with OMAP really have to implement that list like they do any benefit design out in the community. And it's really left to the health plans and the networks of physicians and hospitals and others to, on an individual clinical basis, decide there may be, and this is hypothetical, a dozen treatments associated with a given condition, but which of those treatments is actually used in a particular clinical situation is a physician decision. And some may be used more frequently than others because it's known that they are more good outcomes. So there is, if you will, kind of a delegation within that we assume that through fully capitated health plans and the medical knowledge of which are the best ones to use.
That sense is a pretty good. When we have a new procedure that we have to put on the list, there's kind of three different options, I guess. One is to place the service on an already existing line item.
Mm-hmm.
So we feel that service is comparable in effectiveness and cost with what's already on that line item. And then another one would be to actually create a new line item somewhere else on the list to better reflect its priority compared to the line that's already there. And the third option is simply to leave something off of the list, and that could be done in cases where we just feel like there's not been any evidence that's an effective service at all.
Mm-hmm. If the particular treatment is possibly more costly, what does the commission have to do?
If it's potentially more costly, we certainly notify the legislative leadership and the Office of Medical Assistance Programs about these changes, and then it's basically up to OMAP to work in conjunction with an independent actuary to determine what, in fact, the actual additional cost would be associated with that service and whether or not that fit within the contracts that the health plans have already engaged in with the state. If it does fit within that existing contract, then that service, that change to the prioritized list, could be done as a technical change to the list. If it is determined that it would be outside of the existing contracts, then we would have to come back to the emergency board to ask for additional funding or wait until the biennial review process and the next list is developed to have the actuaries take into account that additional cost.
And you have used the term technical change. Again, I'm not sure whether you're using it in the context of
the
statute.
It's probably a poor term.
It in context of the statute that's written for the Health Services Commission and the adjustment of the line right now. Because the technical change, as it's written in the statute, basically is a technical change due to error and omission. And clearly, a laparoscopic surgical procedure would be a change due to advancement in medical technology. And so, maybe you weren't using it in terms of this statute as far as technical change.
I think what he was trying to describe, Madam Chairman, is what I call interim changes are authorized under two broad classes, technical errors or omissions or changes in medical technology. And the second one, changes in medical technology, is constrained. The number and amount of interim changes are constrained by the impact of putting those on the list relative to the underlying contracts with the health plans. If putting that on the list exceeds some parameters regarding the financing, then it would not go on that
as an interim change, it would have to either be approved through action of the e-board or deferred until the next biennial list and the new budget was developed.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, you're correct. I'm slipping in terminology there. Kind of over the history of the work of the Health Services Commission, somehow technical changes kind of got used as a pet phrase to mean anything done during the interim, and with the new report, I've tried to better differentiate the types of changes that may be done, talking about the entire set of changes as interim modifications, and one subset of that could be technical changes, and another could be advancements in medical technology.
Madam Chair?
Now, I just want to follow up on what you just said. How can you just determine that that's how you're going to classify these things? It sounded to me like you're sort of coming up with your own...
Madam Chair, those distinctions are made in ORS 414-720, paragraph 6, where it says the commission may alter the list during the interim only under the following conditions: technical changes due to errors or omissions, and B, changes due to advancements in medical technology or new data regarding health outcomes. And so I think that's the distinction that, and Darren has perfected, not only for the commission's work, but for the audiences that are interested, be able to say interim changes fall into one of these two categories and to try to show why they are in one of those two categories.
Okay. And I did go back to the statute develop that language.
So I have the statute right in front of me. It's very clear to me that there are only two reasons why the Health Services Commission makes changes during the interim, and they are very clearly those two reasons.
Right.
Madam Chair, could I comment on one additional administrative issue that I think has been and appropriately so, an issue of a fair amount of controversy between the health plans and the Office of Medical Assistance Programs and the Health Services Commission, and they relate to both of these areas, but particularly the changes due to advancements in medical technology. The health plans have really, I think, made a very compelling case that, like in the private sector, they need a benefit design determined for example, a 12-month period. It is fairly stable, that there are not lots of changes that drive both additional costs and perhaps confusions clinically. And we've done, Darren and the Commission and Hirsch and his staff and the leadership of the fully capitated health plan, over the last 12 to 18 months, I think have done a really good job to try to get this handoff more rational so that we don't create dislocations in either the financing aspects or the kind of the clinical management aspects. So we're trying to minimize the number of times that we do this for convenience of paperwork and understanding. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to let you know that happened, because if you look back on this 3 or 4 years ago, it was much more like changes might happen, if not monthly, quarterly, or several times a year, and it became very difficult for all parties to manage under that. And I think we've tried our best to work that out so that everybody sees that it's a more stable process.
Well, along with what Representative Loken asked earlier about, inserting on something within a line, and then you explained that it, for instance, the new technology with the laparoscopic surgical procedures, we were told on Monday that one of the items that was added to the list was a treatment for hepatitis C, and that was moved from line 620 to line 330. Now, how did that happen, and what is on line 330 that relates? And just if you could explain that, because it's a movement within. But I'd like to understand better how that works.
Madam Chair, line 620 previously included all chronic viral hepatitis, so viral hepatitis A, hepatitis B, C, D, and they keep finding more and more. Line 330 includes chronic hepatitis of other origins, and so they certainly have there's certainly some similarities between the two lines in type of disease. It's different agents that are actually causing the disease. Historically, non-viral hepatitis has been much more effectively treated than viral hepatitis until the advancements around interferon and now combination therapy, including interferon rivaviram. So there are, in fact, now treatments that can effectively treat viral hepatitis B and C along the same lines as the treatments for other types of hepatitis. And so once that new technology came about and we did extensive research and took testimony on the effectiveness of that new treatment, we found it to be pretty much in line with the existing treatments for other types of hepatitis, and that prompted the move from line 620 to line 330.
And then Senator Shields?
I just wanted to follow up on that question, because last week there was a lawyer in here who talked about hepatitis C, and he was Native American, and I decided to talk to him after the meeting, and he said that a lot of people have real misunderstandings of hepatitis C. He's become an expert in the field and was going to send me a lot of stuff. You're suggesting, I guess, that it got moved up because now there's more of a potential for cure than there was years ago. Is that the idea behind it? And in fact, since that is a major health situation, I'd like to know, what is the cure rate for this hepatitis C thing? Or can you explain that a little bit more?
Madam Chair, or Senator Shields, I'll try to, again, being a non-medical person. Basically, before the discovery of the use of interferon for hepatitis C, there virtually was no treatment alternatives for that disease.
And what happened to people with it?
It's a fairly slow-progressing disease that goes over the period of maybe 15 to 20 years. It starts out with virtually no symptoms. And most people do not know that they have hepatitis C, have to be tested for it to find out that it exists. Some people do have certain symptoms of this liver disease. And as time progresses, a person may remain symptomatic or may progress to other levels of more serious disease, such as the cirrhosis of the liver, and other more fatally involved diseases that can require expensive healthcare services and even transplantation. So it's a fairly unpredictable disease. You don't necessarily know which people will progress to these more severe cases. And with interferon, initial studies were showing that about 40% would have no signs, would have what they call sustained response to treatment, and would have no signs of the disease 6 months after they finished their course of treatment of interferon. Since that time, there's been some changes in the way that they've measured responses to treatment, and so some of the effectiveness rates appear to be somewhat lower, but it's kind of changing the bar in terms of how they're measuring things. And now with a new drug called ribavirin, used in conjunction with interferon, they're showing effectiveness rates, again, kind of in the 40 to 50 percentile range for the sustained response of treatment. And so by treating them early in the disease, you are hopefully preventing the more severe illness that can appear later on. But you basically need to treat everybody because you don't know what individuals are going to progress later on.
Madam Chair, one quick follow-up. The one thing that you've left confused is when you say the disease can be essentially no symptoms, mm-hmm. and it can take 20 years mm-hmm. previously before it would kill somebody or something. Do you treat people when they develop symptoms, or do you treat them when you detect the hepatitis C virus at the front end? I mean, where does the health plan come in?
Mm-hmm. Basically, you need to treat somebody before they have severe symptoms. They can have virtually no symptoms or have some very minor symptoms and still be at a place where treatment will be effective. If they've progressed too far into the symptomatic stage at this point in time, they're not showing that the treatments are very effective.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate
you're welcome.
Understanding
you. Mm-hmm. Representative
Loken.
Do you have another question?
No.
Okay. Okay. Well, if there are no further questions, we appreciate you coming back.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for having us. And we're available during the deliberations. If you have more technical questions, we'll be more than happy to get them, try to get the answers to you.
Okay. Thank you very much. That will just about let me make a couple of announcements while you're here.
We're
all here, and we're hearing all of them, yes. Monday we're going to come back, and I think we're going to discuss the grant for the commission. Is that right? The grant that we were not able to come to a decision on. And so we'll probably come back for that on Monday. And then, Katie, what are the other schedule?
We're scheduled at least tentatively to start work sessions on the human resources budget on Tuesday, starting with adult and family services division.
So it would be real helpful if you could be here.
If you're here.
And we start moving on the market. So, and I'm just delighted. This is one of the few days that we've ever been able to end
really
early. So,
congratulations.
We are adjourned. We'll reconvene on the